The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Sean's here, but we're going to do a slightly... We're going to do a slightly informal setup today. And just for the purposes of what the organizers want or don't want, I will just name this panel, which is called... gave it a really important title. Roundtable on Training Political Cadre, Historical Lessons and Current Methods. And the speakers are, I'll just let the speakers introduce themselves as they start rather than wasting time with that. And we didn't talk about an order. I'm happy to kick it off. And then people can just jump in as they please. Well, I think we'll all speak fairly briefly, certainly less than 10 minutes apiece, I think, and then we'll just open it up for discussion. And sometimes I think there is a kind of question and answer format, which is fine if people want to do that, but also if people have comments, you don't have to ask a quote-unquote question. You can make a comment, say your piece, etc.
All right.
So what we wanted to do, my name is Todd Creshen. I'm I write for a socialist worker newspaper. I've been in the ISO, the International Socialist Organization, for I guess it's now my whole adult life since I was 20. So that's a long time. What I wanted to do is just lay out a few ideas about how a conception of what does cadre mean? What are the social, historical, political contexts in which there's a real layer, a social layer of cadre produced, and not simply an accumulation of individual people who join this or that political organization. And then just some thoughts on what we do in the ISO, and people can comment on what's happening today. So to begin with, I'll just throw this out and others can come up with a better definition, but I think a working definition of a cadre, and if you're from England, I think you say cadre, so whatever the word is, it is essentially, it's an old military term, which means kind of a person who's an experienced backbone, a kind of rank and file backbone of an army. So an experienced soldier. That's sort of where the term comes from, if I'm not wrong about that. And the idea that it's used in political senses is you have a political movement, a mass movement, a political party, some sort of social movement phenomenon. The cadre are the people who may not be the most famous or recognized leaders. They may be in the rank and file, they may be mid-level leaders, they might be leaders, but they are people who've accumulated through one way or the other a historical experience, a certain knowledge of historical and theoretical events that allows them to both conduct arguments, but to also understand and be swayed by other arguments that are being made, that can offer both an on-the-spot analysis, so you might think of a shop steward in a trade union situation, who can both know the contract, who can also understand the implications of racist division at work, can understand in a basic way how to explain to coworkers why there might be layoffs happening, or why our country has invaded another country. A person who has a basically decently well-rounded political view of what they're attempting to do, and some experience to back it up. So I would actually make a distinction between, not that there's anything wrong, and there's many people here who are academics professionally, but book knowledge does not equal being a cadre. But neither does simple personal experience equal being a cadre. There has to be some mix of historical view, of theoretical training, of political education, and practical experience that gives you the capacity to act on your own, which I think is a critical part of a definition of cadre. You're not waiting to be told what to do. You can make your own decisions, but also can act in concert with other people committed to the same political or social project. And so I see the notion of cadre as some constellation of that educated, experienced, capable person embedded in a social movement in relationship to other people who function like that. So that it's a social layer that can actually transmit and develop and sustain political or social organization. So that's what I have in my head as a working definition. Now, in terms of the historical circumstances that produce this layer of cadre, coming from a Leninist tradition in a Bolshevik sense. When the Bolsheviks, or when Lenin talked about a vanguard party, there's often, in my opinion, and Paul can correct me on this, a mistaken view of a vanguard party is the party with the right program, or is a group of people with the right program. And I think that's a very bad definition of a true vanguard party. A vanguard, in the sense of that Lenin was talking about, is a mass social layer of revolutionary workers embedded in their workplaces, neighborhoods, and other situations. Today, universities and other places, and that social layer of tens of thousands, or at least thousands of people who have that constellation of experience I spoke of before, is really, in one way or another, when we talk about a vanguard of the working class, we're not talking about just some correct ideas. We're talking about an actual social layer of thousands or tens of thousands of people embedded in a particular country or set of countries that can act in common and have a political commitment to a common goal. Now, what historical situations produce those? I would argue that in the United States today, we do not have a social layer like that. We have people who are activists. We have a large number of activists, but we don't have, and again, maybe this is controversial, I don't think we have what you could call a vanguard of the working class, in the sense of a coherent social layer of people, not necessarily all in the same political organization, but committed to a common vision of socialist revolution or mass transformation, with a common language, a common experience, and whatever debates and differences amongst them, a common commitment to working together to influence the other sections of the working class. So what in the past has created those situations? Beverly Silver and Kim Moody and Aaron Baninoff last night gave the introduction, the plenary session, and I thought they did an excellent outline of looking at class composition in the world today. And one of the things that Beverly Silver really focused on was she had this great chart which showed global class struggle and social struggle over the last 150 years. And there's two enormous spikes. One is in the run-up to the Russian Revolution, and then after World War II in the run-up to the Chinese Revolution. And I'll just speak about the United States for a moment. Between 1900 and 1921, there were something like 30,000 strikes in the United States. Between 1916 and 1921, there were 20,000 strikes involving some 15% of the American workforce. Maybe it was 20% over the course of those years. That level of social struggle and strikes created, or at least potentially created, the social conditions in which a real vanguard can arise, and embedded, or the composition of that vanguard, is the production of thousands of people who are political cadres. They may have slightly different training, they may have different experience, but their experience and their social conditions mean that they are embedded with each other in this common project of trying to confront capitalism. So that's, I think, a precondition. Some much higher level of class and social struggle is really a condition. And then there's other things, like how do you develop a political common language? And even if you have debates amongst the revolutionary left about what particularities of this or that view you take on a historical or a theoretical or a current question, essentially a common commitment or a common ethos to capitalism is the problem, we're trying to get rid of it and replace it with socialism. That political element isn't automatic. That comes from ideological streams, it comes from pedagogy, it comes from the past, it comes from history, it comes from defeats that we're still suffering through, it comes from victories. So that's not as simple as, Paul has written, and Paul I'm sure will agree with this, Paul has written wonderful books that if you read them, they will help convince you to become a communist. But the problem of how do we reproduce this layer of cadre in the United States is not reducible to, if Paul just sold more books, then we'd have a social layer of revolutionaries. It's got to be a much more complex process. And the last thing I'll say, and I'll end here, is it also matters tremendously what our enemies do. So in the past, the state repression has been, and I would argue, a key element in how to compose a revolutionary layer of people who understand that while you can make reforms, there are severe limits in a capitalist system to how far reform can go. and so state repression, state intimidation, and all of the things that we're familiar with are really a key component to understanding or to why cadre are created and what people think of that. You know, fortunately or unfortunately, we have a state today which is in the business of dishing out punishment on a global level, and I think that people can learn the lessons to reorganize a layer of revolutionary cadre in the tens of thousands in this country. We have a responsibility to try to teach, to try to educate, to work together, to share experiences. But there's no way for us. We'll have the repression. I'm unfortunately very confident of that. What we don't yet have is the mass struggle, which is able to bind together this layer of people. So what we still have is individuals who are more or less scattered, who are trying to figure out how to answer some of these questions. Well, into there. I don't know which one of you would like to go next.
I'm still chewing on what you just said. I was going to make a joke about how I showed up late and how I failed the first lesson of cadre training, but it turns out we're all starting late, as we might predict. I want to say just a couple things. First about sort of organizational background, and then the locations in which I've seen that organizational background, my own organizational background, play out, and what that says, I think, about my understanding of cadre and thinking through the current moment. So what I'm gonna say has its broadest basis, the foundation in my experience in an organization called Bring the Ruckus, which is a national revolutionary organization that existed for about 10 years until 2012, and engaged in cadre organizing explicitly, subconsciously cadre organizing, embedded within mass work in a number of cities across the country, and which took a specific orientation toward the centrality of white supremacy, the role of cadre in pressing forward struggles against white supremacy as a precondition for class unity, to put it in that sense. Now, I think what I want to underline is the fact that this organization was the sort of organizational heir of another organization from the 60s, 70s, and 80s called the Sojourner Truth Organization, a sort of communist organization that centered white supremacy. And I say that because the importance of that comes from the fact that we actually adopted and inherited the sort of training program of that organization, a theoretical training program for cadre that was called, with what I like to think of as kind of a very Leninist hubris, how to think. This phrase of Lenin. And it was a training in dialectics. It was intensive. It was hundreds of pages of reading that was digested in intensive courses for militants, and that we discussed in relation to the organizing that people were doing on the ground on a national level. And this was geared toward building an understanding of our role and our ability to intervene in the world around us. In other words, we read people like Lenin and Gramsci and also Fanon and C.L.R. James in particular, and Du Bois, for an understanding of U.S. history and also an understanding of the militant, the role of the militant, and the role of cadre in particular. And this was always geared toward, I think, recognizing, and it kind of dances around this question of the vanguard, because we're always very critical of calling it a vanguard, precisely because the goal was to underline how militants and the general population possess a kind of dual divided consciousness, dialectically divided, that contains the potential, not the general population, but the generally poor and oppressed population, that contains a sort of revolutionary seed and kernel at the same time that it contains a kernel of reaction. And that the goal and the function of the cadre is to intervene in those spaces in a way that's able to kind of leverage that kernel and push it in a revolutionary direction. To understand that this revolutionary potential is out there, and to understand that it's not always ourselves who are going to sort of build that potential or bring and deliver a science to the masses, but that there needs to be a way to leverage and press in that direction. In terms of the way this played out, I should say that it draws on my experiences in both Oakland, California and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in moments in which groups of organized cadre play really just astounding roles in sharpening contradictions, in moments of struggle, in social explosions, particularly thinking of beginning in January 1st of 2009, the upsurge in Oakland after the killing of Oscar Grant, which has totally transformed that city and transformed what has come since. And as Cadre on the ground there, the intervention, the potential for intervention, not just in ideological training, not just in discussing and debating with people, but on the ground, giving speeches, pressing people, drawing out the revolutionary potential of people in the streets, was absolutely decisive. It helped to, you know, to press, you know, the city toward more radical demands. It helped to sharpen consciousness. In other words, when people are rebelling against police murder, how is that then formulated? You know, how do you deal with very difficult questions of what the demands are? How do you bridge between very concrete demands of, for example, calling for a cop to be arrested and then put on trial? And how do you connect that to a more revolutionary horizon? And I think that's the really difficult and very concrete task that people were engaged in. In Philly, we've seen something very similar in which very, very small numbers, shockingly small numbers of people engaged in struggles around police violence consistently, proactively, aggressively, combatively, you know, in constant clashes and conflicts, attempting to embarrass, you know, the city and embarrass the police, actually, I think, created the basis for much broader, much more radical struggles, especially around the time that Ferguson and Baltimore then kicked off. We had just this one, just really, you know, astonishing moment was the Baltimore Solidarity March in Philly. It's the kind of thing where you're organizing small marches, rallies around someone who's been killed by the police. People are paying attention, not everyone is showing up. And then when you just call a rally in solidarity with Baltimore, I don't know if you were there, but about 2,000 people showed up, and then sort of people who were not organizing before, not members of organizations, probably had never been to a march before, and demanding and pressing beyond organizers, and pressing beyond the organized left to sort of take highways and block streets to show a real sort of felt affinity with the people of Baltimore in struggle. I think that points toward one of the main things that I think I want to say about Cadre organizing. And I think, you know, you mentioned this when you were first describing the need for this kind of layer. I had this sort of gut worry that the question is, well, how do you, you know, do you build that? What do you do with that? And then you pointed toward the way that it emerged in the course of upsurge, right? And I think that's the really important point. And it's an important point in general, but in particular for our present, because we have to know how to understand political moments, right? We need to know how to understand that when you have a moment of upsurge, this is a gift, first of all, for organizing. It's something you need to understand how to take advantage of. And you need to work this balance between long-term, slow, you know, building work and the ability to react when there's a moment of upsurge, when you need to maybe shift course very dramatically, and in particular, when you need to be able to draw huge numbers of people to your side. And this points, I think, more generally to what some people call the intermediate level organizing. So for example, in these instances that I've talked about, Cadre, very small numbers, again, 5, 6, 7 people, intervened in mass work, on the one hand, very open mass work, and in a sort of in-between category, not as open, not as broad as mass work, but of a sort of very militant, intermediate organizing, in which people were more tightly organized, but didn't share maybe the deep affinities and long-term unity that Cadre might share. And so providing some kind of bridge to working and entering into that mass work through intermediate level organizing, particularly in those moments, right? In moments in which people are being thrown out of their comfortable positions, a moment in which I think, and this is probably more controversial, I think the question of left populism is crucial and it needs to be struggled with. And how is it that we can use a populist rupture to draw large numbers of people into militant activity? And then how, in the long term, is really where Cadre and even organizational structure plays a big role, which is to then try to give that momentum stability in time. Right? When we, you know, particularly in anti-police organizing, which is most of what I do, you have this life cycle where there's an explosive response to a particular killing, people are mobilized, sometimes for a few weeks, sometimes for months, and then there's a sort of dying down of that energy. You know what's going to happen again, we know what's going to happen again, and so how is it that we build structures and build institutions and build consciousness in a broader sense that can help us bridge and move on from one sort of moment to the next moment? And then maybe just to say one thing, which is for me a caution always, which is to understand the way that training Cadre also determines, or how we train Cadre has a huge implication in terms of what our organizations look like, who we recruit, whether or not we're actually reproducing structural hierarchies of class and race and gender in our organizations. And I say this in a kind of reflexive way about, you know, mentioning this dialectics training that we would all engage in. And it was, like I said, it was 400 pages. It was heavy reading. We always engaged it and dealt with it in relation to concrete questions, but it was also very daunting for a lot of people that, you know, we wanted to recruit. And it also had a filtering effect often, so that the people that end up often finishing a very intensive course are maybe university students, or, you know, people who don't have to work to take care of families, or, you know, tendentially white and male. And so I think we need to be very careful and very reflective about how it is that we engage in cadre organizing, and recognize the fact that it doesn't always need to be incredibly intensive, that precisely what we're learning when we're studying these things is the way in which we can look at every aspect, every artifact of the world dialectically, think about it in a certain kind of motion. And we can do that equally well through films and through discussions and through conversations on the street corner when we're door knocking. Always conscious of the fact that, you know, as I said, the people, that everyone's got this kind of divided consciousness that can be drawn out in a sort of close conversation. That's what I said.
My name is David Thompson, and I'm the chair of the Philly Socialists, which is a multi-tenancy socialist group. And I moonlight as Gio's barista sometimes. Today, I guess I want to kind of just give you a window into how we work in Philly Socialists, and how we think about developing our cadre. It's a kind of a different approach than a lot of the existing left groups that were out there, certainly when we were founded in 2011. When I was thinking about how I was going to sort of frame this, I was thinking about the first leadership retreat I went on with this group when I was kind of checking it out, and I liked that it kind of had this project-oriented focus. But one of the founders said to a group of about 12 people in the room, like, how many of you have experience managing or leading a team of people to get something done? And no one raised their hand. And I think you'd find that to be the case in a lot of places, in a lot of leftist groups. And I think we all know maybe like a lot of the reasons for that, the sort of total breakdown and the assaults on a lot of our working class institutions. Your average person is not going to join a union to get that kind of experience. A lot of people who are radicalizing are maybe invested in their careers in a way where they get the kind of experience to manage a project and that kind of thing. We are more and more atomized and alone. So that's the first problem I think that Philly Socialist approach wants to address, is that basically there isn't a lot of know-how on, like, among newly radicalizing people. So some groups' solution is to kind of seek out, like, recruiting from people who have these kind of skills. There are leftist groups out there who try to recruit from the nonprofit sector, or try to recruit from, like, union organizers, that kind of thing. And some groups maybe don't see this as an issue to begin with, and focus on building up other skills. They focus on building up writing skills, public speaking skills, things like that. But I think the sort of people who started Philly Socialists felt that we had to address this other problem, which is the very small base that exists for far left politics right now. I sometimes think about the fact that in Philadelphia, like, Hillary crushed Bernie in the primaries there. The Democratic establishment there has the loyalty of a lot of the politicized layer of people. There are plenty of non-politicized people out there, but we have a lot of work to do to get back to the point where the far left was in times like the 30s or 60s. So we think a lot about, like, the work that the Black Panthers would do to try and get their win of a following for their politics in the community. Or like the American Communist Party in the 30s, the work they would do organizing unemployed councils or tenant councils, stuff like that. In my personal opinion, I think these days, like, the right wing and you know, the church has gotten a lot better, actually, at reaching out to people in this kind of way. They used to be afraid of the left. They used to have to, like, fund people like Saul Alinsky. When he got his start, it was a lot of church money, basically, because they were so afraid of how loyal the communists, or, like, how loyal a lot of people were becoming to the communists, because of how effective the communists were. Same thing, like, I know there was, like, in Harlem, in the 30s, the church was really worried there too, and they felt that they were in direct competition with the Communist Party for the loyalty of the people who lived in Harlem. So those are the kind of projects that Philly socialists set out to focus on first. So for several years, there was kind of this feeling that we would kind of leave ourselves weak in the area of political education, because so many other leftist groups were really good at that. But there wasn't really a lot of on-the-ground work being done. So we started out doing what we call Serve the People projects, inspired by the Panthers and other groups. So that's how it started. And those projects kind of are the sort of early layer of kind of like a ladder of engagement we have for our cadre. A lot of people who, like, we recruit at, like, tabling type of things, like, they don't really know what to do, but we have a very easy in, which is to come tutor at, like, our ESL classes that we run in three neighborhoods, we've been running for 5 years. So they can come and tutor at an ESL class with basically no experience and be involved in our organization's work. Early on, we did, like, before I was involved, there was a food distribution program, a Red Plenty food distribution program. We have a community garden, the Cesar Andrew Iglesias garden up in North Philly in a Puerto Rican neighborhood. Just took over a vacant lot there and have turned it into a space that's a garden, but also like a community gathering place. There, a couple times a year, there's like a big sort of community performance there. And that's another kind of easy way for people to be like, I want to get involved, what can I do? Check out the garden, check out our ESL classes. Sort of moving up from the sort of the people work, we then try to get people involved in our recruitment and retention work, which would just be going to tables, like at different festivals kind of things, and just talking to people about our organization. Or doing work like data entry and phone calls, maybe coordinating a happy hour or something like that. Or even recently, like, we're working on fundraising. Like, we're in the midst of our annual crowdfunder right now, and so it's very easy to kind of help people. Like you can set your own personal goals on your page and run a fundraiser. So after kind of Serve the People in recruitment and retention, we've started to develop over the last couple years projects that we like to say Fight the Power. And this is work that's kind of more emotionally exhausting. It's more complex, and it's not for everyone. But we have people who come in and do this kind of work who've come up in other ways. So we started doing this work with an approach called like the Solidarity Network approach, just like an anarchist informed idea. It's basically you just look for people who are getting screwed over by a boss or a landlord, you get a group together and wage sort of direct action campaigns against the boss or landlord. So we did this with a couple tenants who were having terrible mice problems, couldn't get repairs, and couldn't get anything done with the landlord, and basically just sort of escalatingly shamed the landlord until they caved because they didn't want to deal with us anymore. From that work, over the last year and a half, we founded like a new mass organization that we're trying to build up, the Philadelphia Tenants Union. So that's kind of where we send the people who want to do really deep organizing, who want to go and like go into apartment buildings, just start knocking on doors, getting to know people and agitating people and setting up campaigns in those buildings or on the block level. And we're also, there's a legislative component there where we're fighting for a citywide reform. And we just started a new kind of Fight the Power thing called, which is basically just an immigrant solidarity working group. And right now, the idea there is they're going to be working on campaigns targeted at like collaborators with the Trump anti-immigrant regime. So our first action is going to be a rally on Drexel's campus. So they're doing that in collaboration with our student group there. It'll be a rally to demand that Drexel become a sanctuary campus. So the point is that this kind of work is something that that is difficult, but like there's a way to get into that kind of more computational work. Some people never advance into it, but people get experience that they can bring to it. So like for instance, when you know we have a guy who just got involved to work for Bernie and did like organizing in Iowa and Indiana, and he can come into our tenant union work and be like, okay, I'm gonna develop you guys a field plan, like this is what we're gonna do to try to get this reform done. But he has experience from a political campaign that like most people do not. Like the average person who joins our group does not, and we have to get that experience another way. These projects, which a lot of them, when we started in 2011 and succeeding Obama years, it was basically low ebb of kind of social mobilization. So these projects gave us stuff to do basically with each other that helped us build really strong working relationships and sort of skills and trust that helped us when we decided we had the capacity to move into like more traditional work that socialist groups do, like propaganda. So only after 6 years we started up, and this is just something you can pick up at the end if you want. We have like a paper now that we put out every month that we think is really good, but we waited 6 years to get started on that. And now it's just sort of running on its own very smoothly. And the same thing goes for protest work. When the moment changed, like Gio was saying, like when Trump was elected, basically, we were like, we're in a new period here. We really have to like turn and start doing more of this mass-oriented work that we've, you know, we need to go out to the media, we need to stop our media blackout, which we basically had, like we're not gonna talk to the press for no reason. So we sort of jumped down front when Trump and the Republicans came to town for their like leadership retreat. And we were able to lead a march the night that Trump was in Center City and have it be like a militant, unpermitted kind of march that tangled up downtown, it was very organized, like in a way that a lot of other socialist groups in town, I think, couldn't have pulled off, marshals and that kind of thing, and de-escalation team. So when we were ready to kind of move into that work, the project work that we'd done prior to that helped us do it, I think, in a more effective way. And these demonstrations are important. We did another one sort of following up on that for International Women's Day. And we had this was not, you know, based on like a spontaneous mobilization, but we were able to turn out 500 to 700 people and again do sort of militant, unpermitted march. And it's not Black Bloc, but it's also like a stepping stone from the kind of like nonprofit politician sanctioned parades that are kind of what, if you know, people were kind of waking up, that's all they have, right? So we're trying to giving them something that's like gonna help them be like, oh wow, like people can just like take the street, like this is great, you know, like this is that kind of thing. So we also do like along with just running these projects, we have a training program that we're working on making more systematic, but it's involved like annual retreats where we go and sort of just do presentations on like topics like the history of the socialist movement and kind of like what is power, you know, which is an important thing for us to do when we're trying to convey to people like this is why we're not like trying to run candidates right now or take state power. Presentations on things like organizing versus activism, social network theory. So we do those retreats every year, and we also run events that we call Camp Cadre, which is like a sort of 101 introduction to our organization. When we run the project, we've established a good culture of mentorship. So when someone new, okay, cool, yeah, so that's basically, we have a culture of mentorship where we pair new people with experienced people, and give resources to people who want to start new initiatives. We have someone started this thing called Radical Soups where people get together and have political conversations over soup, totally new person. This year we'll be developing like a sort of intensive political education program. But in all of our work, I think the important thing is that we try to celebrate failure because we're gonna fail all the time. And we really work to like help people stick around and like do things in a sustainable way where it's like you fail once, but you stick around and you keep getting better and better. so, and the last thing I say is just like, for people who are interested in getting something started, just, you know, like, we want to be there to help people who want to start project-oriented socialist organizing, and anyone can and should do it.
I'm Justin. I'm from Kentucky Workers League, and I was originally supposed to be Kate Miller Byrne from our organization. She couldn't make it. Interestingly, kind of dovetailing on the sort of less intensive cadre development piece, like, we've been very successful in Lexington, Kentucky, in creating an openly socialist organization, kind of built on the same lines as Philly. In fact, we had pretty intimate ties from the very beginning of our organization 3 years ago or so. But I think that's helped us, like, create a majority women organization, and we also have a majority of women in leadership. It's just something we're proud of. But anyway, I think David touched on a lot of the major themes of both of our organizations. We consider ourselves to be sister organizations. What I would add, I guess, like, what makes us unique is that we've kind of taken, I think, the Philly model and turned it on its head, not necessarily on purpose, but we got involved in some pretty militant actions, like, kind of right off the bat, and it really, I think, helped us develop a really solid core of people. Like, we blockaded an illegal eviction in Lexington, which is something that had never happened before. And that actually ended up working, much to our surprise. But we got this lady the time that was required by law for her to move, and so she wasn't bullied out by this gentrifier in town. And then we also ran a campaign where a friend of ours was terminated for his gender identity, and that was kind of an ongoing, very militant campaign. We launched a rally in Lexington on May Day 2 years ago, I think. On relatively short notice, we had about 50 people and shut down their office and kind of took the street in front and so on. And again, something that I don't, as far as any of us know, has never occurred in Lexington, Kentucky before, but yeah, I mean, I don't really, I think you covered what we do fairly well. I mean, we share a lot of the same philosophy. I know you mentioned social networking theory. It's something that we're big on, sort of, in terms of cadre development particularly. We have actually a constitutionally mandated social event monthly. So in the jargon of social networking theory, like, we call that, like, building density. So, like, building density between our cadre, so we'll go bowling or, you know, drink beers or what have you. I mean, I think that's been a very important piece, because up until the election, or, like, shortly before, we were a fairly small organization, so I think maybe 20 people or so. We've doubled in size. We're over 50 now, and growing every day. And so I think in the kind of in the lean period, as we were getting our feet under us, like, building that density was very important, not only for retention, but, like, I think drawing in people, they saw that we were, you know, a closely connected organization and so on. I don't know, you've been talked at enough. But
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.